Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, August 19, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call, When Lines in the Sea Fail, China Dismisses the Hague Arbitration Court Ruling. My name is Tim Courtney. I'm the Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and note that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome our experts, Professor James Kroska, the Howard Levy Professor in the Stockton Center for the Study of International Law at the U.S. Naval War College, and Professor Julian Koo, the Maurice Dean Distinguished Professor of Constitutional Law at the Hofstra University School of Law. Thanks to you both for joining us. With that, I will turn it right over to Professor Koo.
Thanks so much. Thanks, everyone, for joining in for this call. What I'm going to do is, this is Julian Koo. I'm just going to give about 5 minutes, hopefully, of background on the arbitral case that was released on July 12th, and then I'll turn it over for some analysis by Professor Kroska, and I'll come back later on with my own thoughts on the case. But I want to start with about 5 minutes of background just to set up our discussion. So this dispute, the case that was released on July 12th by UNCLOS, United Nations Law of the Sea Arbitral Tribunal, was a dispute between the Philippines and China. The dispute began really back in 2012 when the Chinese Coast Guard evicted Philippine fishermen from an area near the Philippines known as the Scarborough Shoal, which both the Philippines and China claims legal rights over. And since that time, the Chinese Coast Guard has refused to allow Filipino fishermen to fish in this particular area and in various other areas in the South China Sea that both the Philippines and China claim. In January 2013, the Philippines initiated an arbitration under Annex 7 of the United Nations Convention for the Law of the Sea, the UNCLOS, as I'll call it, the Law of the Sea Treaty, is something that both the Philippines and China are members, are signatories to. So they're both bound by this treaty. Under this treaty, every state has to agree to submit disputes concerning the interpretation or application of the Law of the Sea Treaty to binding dispute settlement. And in this case, both of them had effectively chosen arbitration as a method of dispute settlement for disputes of interpreting the treaty. Now, members of the treaty can exclude jurisdiction for disputes concerning maritime sea boundary sort of delimitations and historic bays and titles. And China did this in 2006, but the Philippines tried to avoid this jurisdictional problem by challenging in the arbitration not China's sea boundary claims, but the legal status of various land features that China claimed belonged to it. So, for instance, the Philippines argued many of the features that China claimed or currently occupies are not islands or not even rocks, they're just underwater land features, and under the treaty, the Law of the Sea Treaty, such land features cannot generate maritime rights. They don't generate any territorial sea. They don't generate any economic rights to exploit the fishing or to use exploit the undersea resources. And so this sort of technical dispute is what the Philippines argued and focused on in their arbitration proceeding. Now, the important thing to note here is that so it started in 2013. From that moment, China has refused to participate at all in the arbitration, arguing that it was beyond the jurisdiction of the tribunal for the reasons I just discussed. China did not submit any briefs. It did not appear in the tribunal hearings. It did not officially make any legal statements to the arbitral tribunal, although they made a lot of public statements on their views on the legal issues. So this went on. So essentially, the Philippines had the arbitration, but China just never showed up. But they went ahead and had the arguments anyways, and they filed. And the tribunal does have the power to continue with the proceeding even if one side doesn't show up, and that's what happened here. The Philippines hired a very sophisticated legal team, a U.S. Law firm, Foley Hogue, based in Washington, D.C., and really presented a very sophisticated legal argument over a two-year period, two stages, two hearings. They filed thousands of papers, pages of memos. And this July 12th, just this past month, the tribunal finally issued their award in the case, the final award in the case. And to sort of the bottom line is that the arbitral tribunal ruled in favor of the Philippines on pretty much every issue. It ruled that all of China's claims, especially China's broad claims to vague territorial rights over the entire sea, sometimes called the nine-dash line, is inconsistent with China's treaty obligations. It ruled that none of the features that China claims are islands. All of them are either rocks, which only generate 12 nautical miles of sea rights, or they're not even rocks, they're just underwater land features, which they don't even allow any rights. And so the practical impact of that, for instance, is that China has constructed a number of artificial islands. Most of them are, in fact, several of them are on underwater land features, which do not generate any legal rights. And so those islands also don't generate any legal rights under the treaty to have a 12 nautical mile territorial sea or any other legal rights in the waters around them. And so this is a pretty sweeping decision. Pretty much China lost every substantive argument, which probably not surprising since they didn't show up, but still it was quite surprising how sweeping the decision was. And the tribunal went out of the way to kind of make it clear that China, it doesn't mean China has no legal rights or no legal claims, but whatever the legal claims China has in the South China Sea, if they want to follow the treaty requires those claims to be based on land features that are either rocks or islands, and that all the land features that China uses are not islands, but they're only rocks or just underwater reefs. And so it sharply limits whatever legal rights China is able to claim in that region, that part of the South China Sea. So I'll just say quickly to sum up, and I'll turn it over to Professor Kraska. China was extremely unhappy with the result. They were unhappy even before it was released. They issued a global PR campaign attacking the tribunal, attacking the reasoning of the tribunal, even questioning the integrity of the tribunal. They've suggested all sorts of terrible things, like they were bribed, or that they were biased, or that there were no Asians on the tribunal. And they also have suggested, most importantly for U.S. perspective, that this whole thing was a U.S. plot, maybe with the Japanese, to try to entrap China in a legal proceeding. And so it has become seen within China as, I think, an American, especially because an American law firm led the Philippines case, that it's been seen as kind of an American plot or American strategy to try to limit China's rights in the South China Sea. And so that's why this award was such an important award, not just for legal purposes, but also affecting not just the relations between the United States, between the Philippines and China, but also between the United States and China. And although the award was issued on July 12th, there haven't been any aggressive actions taken so far by the Philippines to try to enforce the award, even though it theory has the right to do so, or by China to try to defy it. What they've done is they've all kind of stayed relatively quiet in terms of they haven't moved their troops around or changed the status quo. And both sides have said they're going to now negotiate to try to sort of work their way out of this problem. But it's unclear what will happen with those negotiations. So that's where we are right now. And there are concerns, I think, in the United States, especially the United States Navy, is concerned that China will try to expand its presence in the region to try to make sure that this award is not enforced upon them. So anyways, that's where we are now. Let me turn it over to Professor Kraska for some of his thoughts on the award and its aftermath.
Thank you, Julian. That's a fantastic scene setter. One thing that I would add is that if you take a step back and look at the implications of the award for outside of the legal channels, and that is sort of for the real world and the political military implications, it's that it destroyed China's nine-dash line claim, which was the principal edifice that they have used to assert power and make legal claims throughout the South China Sea. So the bottom of the South China Sea is about 1,200 kilometers from the southern tip of Hainan Island, and the South China Sea is larger about 1.5 times larger than the Mediterranean Sea, so it's a large body of water. And I would suggest that China's principal goals in all of this are to, in the words of Admiral Harry Harris, the U.S. Pacific Command commander, which is to establish hegemony, plain and simple. That is that China is seeking to be able to control East Asia and decouple the United States from its five treaty allies, that is Japan, Korea, Thailand, Australia, and the Philippines, decouple the U.S. from its treaty allies as well as its friends and partners in the region. It has partnerships, strategic partnerships with Vietnam and India and several other countries. And China very much has been open about sort of this vision in what they call the G2, that is that the United States is dominant in the West and that China is dominant in the East. So the award really undercuts that, and it does so principally through the nine-dash line, which was the first of four major issues that the tribunal talked about. And in dispensing with the nine-dash line, the tribunal went through arguments over historic rights, which is what China has most often, even though they did not appear through their point papers and white papers, China has most often claimed the area within the nine-dash line as some sort of, as you mentioned, ambiguous or amorphous historic rights claim. And states may exempt disputes over boundary delimitation, including delimitation of historic bays or titles. And China had sort of been counting on that jurisdictional hook to hope that the tribunal would find that it did not have jurisdiction in the case. The tribunal distinguished, though, China's claim of historic title with what might be more feasible are its historic fishing rights. And there are several cases, including the Qatar v. Bahrain case and the Continental Shelf Tunisia versus Libya case, in which courts have said that historic fishing rights in an area do not equate to historic title. And that was really at the heart of China's claim with regard to the nine-dash line. And then furthermore, with the advent of the exclusive economic zone, which is a feature not of customary law but of the 1982 UNCLOS, which entered into force in 1994, and that with the advent of the EEZ, that foreign states that have habitually fished in now what is a new EEZ of a coastal state, such as the Philippines, have only one recourse, and that's under Article 62. Of UNCLOS, which is that they can seek to be allocated excess catch by the coastal state. In other words, China would have to approach the Philippines and see if there is excess catch that is not being consumed by the Philippines, and then they would be able to request that. They wouldn't be entitled to it, but they could request it. But in any event, both in the EEZ as well as the Continental Shelf, all of these new rights in the Law of the Sea Convention were determined to supersede any earlier rights by China or some other countries to the extent that they were incompatible. And so this claim of this sort of vague claim of historic title was soundly rejected. And then the other great aspect that you mentioned was the status of the features, and that is that it's particularly significant that none of the features in the South China Sea were adjudged to be islands that were capable of sustaining human habitation or an economic life of their own, and therefore they were deprived of all of the islands, not just the ones that are controlled by the Philippines or by China, but all of the islands were deprived of any sort of hope for claiming an exclusive economic zone or a continental shelf. And so what that left you with was a series of, as you mentioned, a series of rocks, which may have a 12-mile territorial sea, or low tide elevations, which have no entitlement whatsoever. And these isolated rocks then at most would serve as enclaves within the greater EEZ generated by, in this case, by the Philippines for a number of these features, as well as perhaps by Vietnam or Malaysia. And what this did is it sort of restored the legacy of the EEZ and the Continental Shelf to these developing coastal states as it was envisioned in the negotiations for the Law of the Sea Convention. And, of course, it entirely cuts China out because just by distance from Hainan Island, if they cannot generate a 200-mile EEZ from any of these small features, then they are totally devoid of any sort of EEZ or continental shelf claim. So both of these together have entirely stripped away any sort of sovereign rights or jurisdiction over large areas of water for China, and then it has severely undercut their strategic gambit to control the ocean, to control the South China Sea out to the first island chain, that is out to the chain that runs from Japan down through Taiwan and Okinawa and into the Philippines.
Did you want to? I'll just jump. Is that okay if I jump in now, James?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and I think that's right. I think that we can turn a little bit to the results of, or the impact of the award, which is, I think you're right. I should have probably been more clear. The nine dash line is China's most controversial and difficult to justify claim in this region because, you know, as the treaty, the Law of the Sea Treaty, is basically the idea behind it is that if you have land, then and you have sovereignty of the land, then you start with the land and then you work your way to sea rights. I think the phrase is the land controls the sea. China is really far away. Most of China is very far away, as you point out, from the South China Sea. And most of the states here, like the Philippines, Vietnam, you know, it's right offshore their main coastlines. But China is quite far away, and so China needs to either find land in the South China Sea that it can generate rights for it, or it needs to make these historic claims, which it has, which is that, well, before the Law of the Sea Treaty existed, we've had generalized historic control over this region, so therefore we should be able to maintain that control. And I think the way to think about the tribunal's award is to say that as a legal matter, China can no longer make those legal arguments with any strong credibility, at least in my view, and I bet in your view as well, in the sense that the tribunal, I think, and in my view, rightly said, well, there's not really any basis for this very generalized, vague, historic claim to just the water without any particular land feature that gives you the rights to it. And by the way, any of the land features that you claim, because China claims all of the land features in the region, none of the ones that were raised by the Philippines here are actually give you the kind of rights that you think they do. And in fact, to the extent that you own any of these islands or rocks or whatever they are, they actually only give you at most a 12-mile sea. They don't give you the rights, the overall sweeping power to control all fishing or oil development or natural gas exploration in the whole region, which is what China basically claims it has the right to do. And so as a legal matter, I think the tribunal's award is a pretty dramatic a rejection. And I think it explains why, though, I'll talk a little bit about China has had a very aggressive, very negative reaction to the award. And in fact, they began this PR campaign about 2 months before the award was issued back in May, I think, already attacking the award. And even though in theory it hadn't been released, a lot of people speculate they had somehow dug it out of the their cyber spies had gotten a copy, an early version of it. In any event, they were really pounding the award even before it was released and attacking its legitimacy. But because I think they do feel like the award, it kind of hurts their ability to convince other states to accept their claims in the region, even though China has the strongest military force among all the regional claimants. Obviously, this award undermines a lot of their legal legitimacy. And so what they needed to do was undermine the legitimacy of the award, which they really have tried to do. They went as far, by the way, for those of you who live in New York, they bought for 24 hours the big video screen in Times Square and just had a video repeatedly attacking the arbitral tribunal and its award on repeat for 24 hours in Times Square. So if you wanted to walk through Times Square, you were subject to Chinese propaganda on this issue. So they really felt strongly about it. And I think some of our listeners probably know, China has actually built at least seven artificial islands in the South China Sea, most of them right near the Philippines, at least in Philippines claimed areas. And so that's been a huge point of contention. The tribunal also found that the creation of these artificial islands caused ecological damage in violation of China's treaty obligations. And also these artificial islands don't generate any legal rights either, so which is sort of self-evident from the treaty, that they don't, that the, and at least one of the artificial islands is totally illegal. It's on the Philippines continental shelf. There's no legal right to build an artificial island there because China has no ability to claim any legal rights because it's just an underwater reef they built it on. So it really has that impact. So I'll just say quickly that I think I found that to be a China's reaction was extremely negative. I think they probably rightly they were worried that it really undermines their legal sort of legitimacy, especially since they have been so aggressive about creating artificial islands and trying to. They haven't put any military forces in the region directly, but a lot of people think, including the U.S. Navy, is concerned, at least I think they are, they said they are, that by creating all these artificial islands, China has made it a lot easier to put military assets in the region on a permanent basis and in a way that would be very difficult, or at least give them a huge advantage from a practical standpoint in the region. And so let me just take a couple minutes and say some things about the U.S. Reaction or possible U.S. reaction to this. The U.S. reaction to the award has been somewhat muted but pretty clear. So the U.S. pretty much put out a statement saying, look, this award is legally binding. We disagree with China. China's been arguing it's not, but we think it's legally binding, and we encourage everyone to follow the award. And the U.S. has also been engaging in a diplomatic campaign to try to convince other countries to make similar statements and to try to take a supportive approach in favor of the Philippines and against China. Now, China has been launching a diplomatic campaign the other way, where they've been arm-twisting various allies or friends or other countries to make statements in support of China and against the arbitral tribunal. And it's a very complicated diplomatic game, but essentially, China has been successful in muting the reaction of other countries. Australia, Japan, the United States, the Philippines, of course, all came out pretty quickly with statements that said, look, China should abide by the award. But even the European Union countries, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN, the regional group of Southeast Asian nations, did not come up with a statement as calling on China to follow the award, just saying that in general countries should follow the treaty, but not taking a position on whether the award was binding. So I think China has been successful in, you know, muting the criticism of its position, and even I was surprised the Europeans, who are usually very aggressive about enforcing international law, did not come out with a tougher statement. The other possible impact, though, of the award is, so the diplomatic campaign is the U.S. has been trying to put pressure on China through saying, well, look, other countries, look what this award says about China. That's had limited success, I think, so far. The other way the U.S. could have a reaction would be to launch new freedom of navigation operations, which are essentially the U.S. Navy basically sails where it thinks international law allows it to sail. And in this case, U.S. Navy can now say, look, we're going to sail wherever international law allows us to sail or fly. And international law is going to be defined by what this tribunal says international law allows us to do. And that would allow the U.S., for instance, to sail within 12 nautical miles of one of the Chinese artificial islands, at least one of them, which the tribunal says has no legal basis, and just sail without any deference to Chinese sovereignty claims at all. Up until now, the U.S. has said, well, we don't take sides on sovereignty. It might belong to the Philippines or China. We're not going to take sides. But now I think the U.S. could say, look, you have no sovereign basis here at all. We're just going to show up and just ignore any claims you have to this particular artificial island or the area around it. And that would, I think, would upset the Chinese. But it would also signal U.S. commitment to, I think, as Professor Kraska says, support the treaty allies like the Philippines, but also, I think, too, if the U.S. is serious about trying to get China to abide by the award, that's the way in which it could show its commitment to do so. So, Professor Kresge, I don't know if you have any other thoughts on that, on the enforcement side, or what the U.S. could do or other countries could do.
Sure, thank you. Yeah, I agree with you that that China is now suffering from sort of exposed lack of legal legitimacy because of the case, and they've invested so heavily in this politically and through their industrial artificial island construction, and really what they've been told all along by scholars at just innumerable conferences and track one governmental and track two dialogues that what they were doing was not in accord with the law of the sea. And they've just been very stoic about it. And so I think they have painted themselves into a corner. What I would suggest also is that that the reason why they've not been very amenable to sort of international criticism all along, it's not just recently, but really beginning with their circulation of the nine-dash line through the United Nations in 2009, 6 years, 7 years ago. Since then, they've really not had any support for their claims. They've either been able to sort of cow people into kind of self-doubt or just to be quiet, or probably I would say two-thirds or three-fourths of the scholars and the officials have tended to disagree with their claims, saying that they're unlawful. So China clearly knew what the international community, the sense of legal scholarship and what government officials and countries were thinking. So its surprise, I guess, is somewhat surprising. And I think it's driven then not by the international calculus, but rather by domestic politics. That is, that this is something that Xi Jinping cares personally about, that he's been involved in since before he became president when he was in the Politburo. And it's a convenient mechanism for the Chinese Communist Party to sort of continue its championing of Chinese nationalism, and sort of demonstrating that the Communist Party is at the vanguard of nationalism and is protecting China and eliminating all of the vestiges of colonialism and of the 100 years of humiliation and all the rest. And I think that that's where the capital has been earned on this. And on the other side of the ledger is the increasing political costs that China has experienced as a result. To go back to the question of the islands versus the low tide elevations, as you mentioned, China has constructed these massive artificial islands. Combined, they are several million square meters large now. Really created out of whole cloth, out of very bare features, coral features. Some of them are just low tide elevations that are not even above water at high tide. And China has seven of these large areas, three of them with runways on them, and four of the of these artificial islands have been constructed on high tide features, or that is on rocks. Quartin Reef, Fiery Cross Reef, Johnson Reef, and Gavin Reef North. But as you said, three of these low tide features have now been converted also into artificial islands. Hughes Reef, Subi Reef, and Mischief Reef. And these are massive artificial island complexes with 10,000 foot runways and port facilities and all of the rest. And yet these artificial islands do not acquire any sort of territorial sea or territorial airspace as you would be entitled to with a rock. And it will be interesting then to see whether the U.S. Freedom of Navigation program takes that into account and directly overflies these features, because as you mentioned, then they are still considered part of the Philippine continental shelf. They're just a natural feature on the continental shelf, just like a submerged feature would be, and they have no entitlement whatsoever. Another part of this case that's interesting is that the tribunal went into sort of opened up Chinese activities in this area, and that is The big parts, or the parts that everybody's focused on, have been the nine-dash line, of course, and the territorial entitlements, and those are very important. But I think China's also sort of embarrassed by being taken to task on its activities, which the tribunal deemed were unlawful, in interfering with Philippine oil exploration rights on its own continental shelf, interfering with Philippine fishing vessels in the Philippine Exclusive Economic Zone, and aiding Chinese fishing vessels to exploit fishing, that is basically licensing illegal, unregulated, or unreported shipping fishing, IUU fishing, in the Philippine Exclusive Economic Zone. And these activities are sort of especially embarrassing because the Exclusive Economic Zone and the Continental Shelf were the principal legacy for developing states during the negotiations for UNCLOS. And then to have China be in the position of a bully to try to deny this area to a developing country as poor as the Philippines is certainly doesn't fit with their narrative. And then the tribunal also objected to China's obligations in two other areas, and this was its violation of the collision regulations by purposeful or intentional departures from good seamanship, in particular steaming at a perpendicular 90-degree angle toward vessels, or steaming head-on and then turning away at the last moment. And then the second area is China's sort of open, even knowing disregard for standards for environmental protection or preservation of the marine environment, which apply throughout all the oceans, regardless of what waters, what the status of the waters are. And so taken together, this collection of Chinese activities really shows China in a very negative light, as kind of a not a good citizen of the region and not upholding the law generally. And so it's not just that it's about a sort of a maritime entitlement issue or even the nine-dash line, but it's that even with those disagreements as they exist, that China was not was viewed as sort of not managing disputes in a constructive way.
Yeah, I think that's right, and I think and that's what China's been worried about, that they are losing, that they've taken a blow to their global reputation, or at least their regional reputation, and that's why they've been so vociferous in attacking the tribunal and award. But just before we turn it over to the questioners, I was curious whether, James, you thought of anything that the U.S. should do other than what it's already doing to try to, in response to the award. I mean, do you think that more aggressive freedom of navigation operations by the Navy, or is there something else you think the U.S. should do or could do?
I do. On the one hand, it's better for the United States not to play into a Chinese narrative that this is somehow a G2 issue, that this is the U.S. versus China, and when it's really not. It's China versus principally the Philippines in this case, but also China versus its neighbors, and the U.S. is a tertiary presence. Nonetheless, because the U.S. is so powerful, of course, and has unique capabilities, and underwrites the security in the, not just for its allies, but really for the region, the U.S. is important. And it seems that when you talk to Chinese officials or scholars, they very much are more interested in what the United States thinks and will do more than their immediate neighbors. So the U.S., like it or not, has a role, a very strong presence or influence. The one thing that the U.S. can do, I think it's doing, but it probably could do better, is more frequent freedom of navigation operations, and those ought to be, in my view, combined, and that it shouldn't necessarily be just the United States, but that other countries ought to either with the United States or with each other, or unilaterally ought to also engage in freedom of navigation operations. There are some states that already do so, but they don't report them as like we do as FONOPS. We do an annual, as I know you're familiar with, Julian, we do the annual Office of the Secretary of Defense releases on its website for global security affairs an annual report of the countries that we have challenged through these tangible demonstrations of non-acquiescence to unlawful claims by ships or aircraft operations. And other countries tend not to do that. Now, Australia, for example, says, well, we operate in the same areas with the Royal Australian Navy, but we just don't want to make a big deal of it. We don't want to sort of aggravate tensions. And I understand that to some extent. But on the other hand, if customary law is created through opinio iuris combined with state practice, it seems that there has to be a record of it. You know, if a tree falls in the forest, does it make any noise? And if a fawn occurs but you don't tell anybody about it and there's no sort of public record of it, does that help shape the law? And I would suggest it doesn't. So the United States can do more of what we do. Right now we do what appear to be quarterly operations, which means that we're probably due for one very quickly. The United States ought to do more and in a more unpredictable fashion, I would suggest. We ought to, the second thing is, I would hope that these would be combined, that is, the United States plus other countries, or other countries, other second and third countries working by themselves, such as, say, Japan and Vietnam. And then third, the countries that already operate in the area ought to record and make public that they've been in the area. France has asked the European Union to consider conducting freedom of navigation operations. And in that score, I would say that, of course, the EU ought to be invested in this. But more significantly, NATO should already, in my view, have been conducting these types of operations.
Well, okay, that's interesting. Well, I think maybe that's enough for us to lay the groundwork for discussion, and maybe we could open it up to any questions that our callers might have.
Sure. Thank you both very much for your remarks. I'm now going to open the floor to questions. In a moment, everyone's going to hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key on your telephone. Again, if you'd like to join the queue, hit star and then the pound key on your telephone. We're going to answer questions in the order in which they are received. And with that, we're going to go to our first caller. Go ahead, caller. You have the floor.
Thank you very much for an extremely interesting discussion. Very, very informative. What happens at the point that these discrete kinds of aggressions begin to accrue to the point that the fishing vessels that China has actually behave like a quasi-military, and the countries like Indonesia and South Korea are you know, facing these confrontations that don't have the imprimatur of Chinese military, but still are executing Chinese will, as defended by the Chinese People's Supreme Court in saying that this arbitration decision was wrong and listing the reasons. But at what point does it become a matter of having to assert international will and draw these lines and make a statement? I mean, I understand that it's complicated, but at the point that these various incremental defiances, I guess I would say, are adding up, at what point does it become something insurmountable?
James, do you want to take that? Or?
Sure. I think what you've described is this, what at the Naval War College, some scholars here have called China's maritime militia, which is when the fishing vessels appear to be acting in tandem with China Coast Guard ships. So typically you'll have two or three China Coast Guard ships either over the horizon or mixed with the fishing fleet of 200 to 300 fishing vessels, and seeming to sort of encourage or provide command and control, provide supplies and refueling to the fishing fleet, and using the fishing fleet as essentially a state instrumentality. So, you know, then the tribunal has already admonished China for some of this conduct. In particular, what I mentioned was China's violation of the collision regulations. But I think that there's more as well. There's two aspects to this. There's a peacetime aspect and a wartime aspect. In the wartime aspect, I've written a piece on China's maritime militia and the law of naval warfare for International Law Studies, which is online here at the Naval War College. You can find it. And, of course, this raises the issue of the packet Habana and the use of a civilian object, which is a fishing vessel, as a platform during armed conflict, such as intelligence screening, in which the civilian object loses its protective status. The danger of that is, of course, that there are thousands of legitimate fishing vessels that then are put at risk because some of them are being used for inappropriate or unlawful purposes during a naval war. There's a civilian side to that, and I'm working on a sort of a companion piece of the Chinese maritime militia in the peacetime law of the sea. And this principally raises several instruments, including the articles of state responsibility for wrongful acts if it's attributable to the state, and also some of the violations that were mentioned by the tribunal, in particular the collision regulations and flag state responsibility under Article 92 and 94 of the Law of the Sea Convention, in which the flag state has a duty to ensure that vessels that fly its flag comply with internationally accepted rules. The flag state has the duty to exercise effective jurisdiction over vessels that fly its flag. So if you find Chinese vessels, fishing vessels that are operating in a coordinated fashion and it's apparent that they are violating the law, even if you can't attribute it to the government of China, China still has a responsibility to exercise flag state control. They also have a duty to investigate incidents, both under UNCLOS as well as under the collision regulations. There's a duty by the flag state to investigate incidents, and there's been a number of incidents by the fishing vessels or the Coast Guard ships in which vessels from other countries have been sunk due to ramming and that sort of behavior. And finally, there's duties to exercise administrative and technical control over vessels and certification of crew. So the flag state has responsibility, and then that responsibility grows, of course, if there's attribution of the private conduct to as state agents.
Yeah, and I'll just add here that one of the difficulties here, of course, is I think James is doing the really important work of, you know, explaining and articulating what the legal theory would be to sort of push back against China's strategy, which I'll mention, China's strategy has been, I think as the caller mentioned, to limit, to avoid outright sort of conflicts and use things like maritime militias and really use the law to its advantage. And so the response to that has got to be to use the law, as James has described, to try to push back against China's strategy, which has been called, you know, various, you know, salami slicing or little pieces here and there. So that's why they use their Coast Guard. They don't use their Navy. That's why they use their fishing vessels. And so that's got to be a response. Now, the other problem, though, with I think, is that the U.S. is not, and I think as James mentioned earlier, the U.S. is not a party to this dispute in the direct sense. So a lot of this has got to be something that the states that are in the region that have the disputed claims have to have the capacity to and the willingness to assert. And that's actually one of the greatest challenges and one of China's greatest advantages is that the countries, the principally concerned, the Philippines, Vietnam, Indonesia, Malaysia, they all have varying degrees of interest, even though they're kind of, or willingness to push back and different levels of sophistication in their knowledge of the law or willingness to use the law to push back. And so we need, so I think increasing the capacity of those countries and their willingness to push back is a huge part of the U.S. strategy to the extent the U.S. wants to try to limit China's incursions. But of course, that's also the greatest challenge. It's trying to push those countries. The Philippines, for instance, has very limited Coast Guard capabilities, so they don't, you know, Japan has actually just leased them a bunch of Coast Guard boats to give them the ability to try to make some of the assessments and enforcement mechanisms that James just mentioned. So these countries are just beginning to, at least for the Philippines, is just beginning to have the legal, the physical capacity to carry out some of the legal arguments, that or legal actions that James just described.
Thanks very much for your question. Before we move on to our next one, just a reminder, if you'd like to join the queue for questions, enter star and then the pound key on your phone, and we'll get to questions the order in which they are received. Next caller, go ahead.
Hi there. This is Jeff Smith from the American Foreign Policy Council. I just wanted to thank...
Hey, Jeff.
How are you? Just wanted to thank James and Julian for doing some real great work on these issues over the past 2 years. Anyone following them has really, all their work has been a must read on this subject. I was just in Beijing and certainly talked a lot about the South China Sea ruling. Most of the points brought up were ones that you're familiar with and that have been sort of rebutted by international legal scholars more than a few times, but there were a few that kind of piqued my interest and may be worth further consideration and your thoughts. One that I was not expecting was, you know, a Chinese scholar said, you know, LTEs, these low tide elevations, it's not a settled matter that these aren't considered sovereign territory. I had not heard that before and wondered if you all had any reaction on that, but also this question of whether or not the ruling affected maritime delimitation. That was a point that they seized on many times, saying that their 2006 submission to UNCLOS exempted them from dispute settlement on sovereignty, military affairs, and maritime delimitation. I think it's pretty clear that the first two weren't affected here, but on the question of whether or not the designation of Ituaba as a ROC impacted maritime delimitation, if you could put yourself in their shoes and make the case why it does, and then maybe explain why that view still isn't valid, I think it'd be interesting for some of us to hear that teased out a little more. Thank you.
So, I don't know, Jim, if you don't mind, I'll tackle the second
one. Yeah, please do.
First, and then you can try to tackle the first.
Sure.
Those are good points. I think the core of the Chinese argument has always been that, if I understand it, and thanks for your question, is that the status of these features is itself will concern their maritime limitation, right? So in other words, for instance, when the tribunal found that Ituaba, which is actually currently occupied by the government of Taiwan, but which China also claims, when they found that it was a rock and not an island, it had an impact on their ability to, affects China's maritime delimitation or sea boundary rights, because then they only get 12 miles instead of 200, I guess, if you think about it in those terms, a 12-mile territorial sea instead of 200 nautical miles. And I think that's their basic argument is that when China joined, or at least in 2006, limited its exposure to dispute settlement, they wanted anything that would impact sea boundary limitations excluded, and that's what they have the right to do. And I think I was sort of sympathetic to that argument, but if you take that argument too far, then you really, I mean, there's so many things that could impact sea boundary delimitations. That if you take this too far, it would almost leave nothing left for dispute settlement under the convention, because you know so many things that you do could impact a sea boundary limitations, and also there has to be some way to determine the status of land features. If you exclude determining the status of land features for instance, whether it's a rock or an island, from the scope of the jurisdiction of the arbitral tribunal, then it's almost impossible for, I mean, whole portions of the treaty are just beyond interpretation then, I think. And there are other reasons why you might want to know the whether it's a rock or a land feature. And I think it does seem like, you know, China could just say, look, you know, we have a low tide elevation, for instance, we're going to build something on top of it, and you can't bring us to arbitration, even though, you know, and we say it's an island, and you say, and it's quite clearly not, but you can't challenge that because it affects our sea boundary rights. But if you had no sea boundary rights to begin with, then I'm not sure why you're not allowed to determine the status of the land feature. So I understand where they're coming from on this, but I think the argument for me has always proved too much. It would mean that you could never determine whether something's a rock or an island, because it would always have some impact on your legal rights. Go ahead, James.
Yeah, thanks again, Jeff. Jeff Smith from the American Foreign Policy Council. I actually read your report that was fantastic, and I saw that. I sort of I did notice that issue that you had just raised, that a Chinese official or scholar had said that it's unsettled whether a low tide elevation may generate any sort of maritime entitlement in the law of the Sea Convention. It's just simply not the case. I mean, by the plain reading of the convention, low tide elevations, only in one circumstance may they do they have any effect on generating a maritime entitlement. And, of course, that's if they are within 12 miles of a bona fide island, that is, an island that can sustain human habitation, or a mainland, or in some under Article 13 of UNCLOS, in some interpretations, if they're within 12 miles of a rock as well, which it seems to be, the latter view seems to be the prevailing view, even though I've taken a different view that it has to be a mainland or an island. Nonetheless, I think that the majority view is that a low tide elevation within 12 miles of a rock may then be entitled to a territorial sea, but a mid-ocean low tide elevation has never actually seen that in print until I read your report of the Chinese scholar. So that's just an argument that's just not not credible. I mean, nobody has argued that. It's the first time I've ever heard it. It's not in any of the scholarship. It's not in any of the treaties that I've ever seen on law of the sea. It's not in the negotiating history for the convention. So, it just doesn't have any credibility. With regard to the issue of China claiming that this is really all about maritime boundaries, so the tribunal went through quite a bit of analysis, both in its award on jurisdiction and then its award on the merits, in demonstrating that it's not actually about title to the island. I guess I'm less sympathetic than Julian. I don't really see how, you know, I guess China, if you look at it sort of most sympathetically, China says, the one thing I would say if I wanted to promote that view, I mean, assuming that, you know, that scholars sort of are propelled by kind of nationalist impulses, which maybe they are, maybe they aren't. I think in China they certainly are. You try to be as objective as you can. But if you were to be sympathetic and make that argument, you would say, well, Article 298 allows states to exclude issues of maritime boundary, comma, including historic bays, I think is the
title.
Historic title and bays.
Yeah.
And so there's never been a historic claim like China's that's sort of this massive mid-ocean claim based on historic title. Historic bay claims have generally been very, very small, or at largest, something like the Gulf of Sidra or the Hudson Bay have been historic claims. And so you might be able to make a straight-faced argument in that regard that those have been accepted because they affect the boundaries of these historic titles. What I started with, though, is that the tribunal distinguished between – the tribunal said that China did not make a historic title claim, that they made a historic rights claim, because all of their evidence is that they have the presence of fishing vessels that have visited these features since a long time ago, time immemorial or 5,000 years or whatever. It's all sort of very undocumented, but nonetheless, let's say for sake of argument that Chinese fishing vessels have operated in these waters. The tribunal looked at that and said, yes, they think that Chinese fishing vessels have operated. They identified particularly Scarborough Shoal, but these are historic fishing rights. In fact, if there is one sort of glimmer of light for China in this, it's that the tribunal affirmed that China has historic fishing rights around Scarborough Shoal, which is claimed by both the Philippines and China and well within the Philippine natural EEZ. So I think that it's a fair distinction between historic fishing rights, where you have a presence, which the tribunal said is a function of freedom of navigation. That's not a function of historic title. The vessels were there just like every other vessels because they were enjoying the freedom of navigation and other international lawful uses of the sea under Article 87. Fishing is one of the freedoms of navigation and other international lawful uses of the sea. I think that's a fair reading of the convention. I don't think that there was ever any supposition of a historic title. China didn't raise the issue of historic title during the negotiations for the Law of the Sea Convention, in which China not only participated, but was a leader in the non-aligned and group of 77 states. So I guess that's my response to both of those issues.
All right. Before I turn it back over to our experts for their final remarks, I want to make a quick programming note. Our next scheduled telephone call is on Monday at 2 o'clock, and that's our voter ID debate with Maya Nerona of Baker-Hostetler and Professor Daniel Takagi of Ohio State. So with that, I would like to just kick it back to our experts real quick for any closing remarks that either of you would like to make.
Okay, yeah, if you don't mind, Jim, let me just quickly say
a couple
things.
Yeah, please, go ahead.
One, so I guess for me, I think from the U.S. perspective, we have some thinking to do here in the U.S. U.S. has to do. But I think the case I would make to listeners is that this is a pretty important thing, even though it seems kind of far away and obscure, because it matters a lot to China, and it does affect, I think, a very important area of the for not just allies, but actually it's a really important area of the world. And so it's tempting the U.S. to kind of let this fall away and let it fade away. I think it does deserve it continued to deserve attention from U.S. From the United States and people in the United States. And I think the other pitch I'll make is that the law does seem to matter here. I think it's going to matter because I think the arguments over what the legal rights are and the arguments against China's legal claims is part of the diplomatic and even some of the military sort of positioning in the region. And so the stronger the legal arguments are, the more effective I think U.S. policy and the policy of other countries in the region can be. And I think this award has really weakened China's ability to use the law to convince other countries that its position is a good one. Go ahead, James, if you have any final thoughts.
Sure. Along those lines, I also, I would tend to recommend that people not be sort of wide-eyed liberal international lawyers that think that just talk in terms of sort of the doctrinal issues. You go to some conferences with just lawyers, and it's sort of disconnected from the political military reality. On the other hand, there also is sort of a more realist or dour view that international law, kind of in Hans Morgenthau's vision, is entirely irrelevant. And as a legal realist, I would say that it's not entirely irrelevant, it's not all controlling either. I mean, of course, you have to navigate between these two sort of extremes. And I would suggest that tribunal decision, this award will endure and it will grow with time. It will become more influential. So just like, for example, the U.S. versus Nicaragua decision, which in many ways I think got the law of armed conflict incorrect, but nonetheless, over time, its influence has grown, even though the United States rejected that case. And I would expect that the same would occur here, that past award decisions are regular features of for courts to adjudicate international decisions in the law of the sea, and this is a big one, and it will continue to be prominent in the decades that come.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I'd like to thank Professor Kroska and Professor Ku for lending us your expertise for today's call, and thank you to our listeners and to everyone who called in with a question. Again, please join us on Monday at 2 o'clock for our voter ID debate. But with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.